disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo. On some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This is America, November 13th, 2020. On this episode, first we feature an interview with somebody who works on the This Week in Fascism column here at It's Going Down. They are launching a crowdfunding campaign to help continue and also expand their work, with the final goal of starting a brand new podcast which would be featured here right on It's Going Down. See our show notes for information on how you can donate. We then switch to our discussion, where we tackle what's been happening since November 3rd. How Trump has attempted to hold on to power through a series of legal challenges which seem to be failing, and how he is now calling on the far right for support through street-level mobilization and protests. We discuss where this trajectory may be headed and what we can expect from the Trumpian state. Thanks for listening. Let's get into it. Okay, we have some exciting news in terms of It's Going Down. Most people know that we have a column that comes out every week called This Week in Fascism. We're talking with one of the authors right now, and we have some exciting news about it. Tell us about what's going on with this column.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is Alice. I go by Gothbot Alice on Twitter. And yeah, I'm one of the co-authors for This Week in Fascism, and we are launching a Patreon for the column. We want to be able to, you know, keep providing really great up-to-date news as far as our sort of free fall into fascism in the United States. And especially, you know, with the election and the fascist fuckery that has, sort of ensued as the election has sort of panned out. Things are really ramping up, and we really love this column. It's a labor of love for my co-author and I. And, so we want to launch, we're going to launch our Patreon. It's, patreon.com/ This Week in Fascism. And, we're hoping to, you know, get some donors and hopefully be able to launch a podcast here soon if we can get enough donations.
For people that for some reason haven't read This Week in Fascism, what do they get every week when they open it up? What do they see?
So This Week in Fascism covers all of like the sort of breaking news in terms of what's happening with far right organizing. So this includes where different sort of members of the far right are showing up, how they're organizing, how that sort of organizing is like metastasizing in our communities. We also do a roundup of the weekly doxes that all of the different anti-fascist crews around the country are putting out. So, you know, I think that to me is some of the most meaningful parts of it, because, you know, it's nice to be able to have all of these individuals, you know, hosted in one place for us to reflect on and look back on. And we like to, you know, we want to make sure that what's happening in the United States is, especially as it relates to far right organizing, that we're really helping make sense of it for a broader audience. I know that, you know, as an anti-fascist, it can kind of feel like I'm speaking to an echo chamber of people that already understand what the difference is between a militia or a Christian identity group or a neo-Nazi group. And there are some like nuances to that. And so it's really important to make the far right organizing that's happening make sense to a wider audience. And shout out to the journalists that read This Week in Fascism, and sort of use that as a place to learn and to get a better sense of what's going on. We know that making this sort of information available to a wider audience is really important for us to be able to protect our communities.
Yeah, there's just a fantastic treasure trove amount of information. There's a roundup stuff happening every week. There's a collection of doxes, like you said, which really spans the gamut across North America, people reporting on, you know, everything from neo-Nazis to Proud Boys to Boogaloo types. There's sometimes articles, like this week there's a report from Sacramento Antifa about what happened at the Capitol where Proud Boys attacked people, you know, basically in the wake of the election. Also, lately there's been an arrest kind of sheet, which is chronicled like all the people that have been getting arrested, in terms of just different like murder plots and stuff like that, which is not to celebrate the carceral state, but just to kind of update people on what exactly is happening and who is getting arrested and why, which has kind of shown a light on, you know, all these different murder plots and different things that have happened kind of as the election gets closer and then takes place. Yeah, and there's also information on prisoners, and there's been updates in terms of actions and stuff like that. So it's really been a kind of a clearinghouse for information that normally kind of would have like seeped through the cracks, but is really collected in one place. And I think one of the best things that it's done over the years is that it's offered kind of a spot for anti-fascists really to talk about the kind of the twists and turns of the far right, whether it's, you know, the far right kind of seeping into the mainstream GOP or different groups like the Boogaloo Boys kind of coming out of the woodwork and kind of taking people by surprise and people needing kind of an analysis to figure out these groups and what they're about. But it's really kind of been a place for people to kind of really lay down bare bones information and analysis about what's happening in terms of anti-fascist struggle, but also putting analysis together about street level movements and how they interact with the state.
Totally. I think, you know, being able to highlight the great work that anti-fascists across the country are doing is, you know, it's really important for me, and my co-author, to be able to do that. You know, the people that we sort of interact with day in and day out understand that, like, the Proud Boys are bad, and that fascism is scary, and that we ought to do everything we should do to fight it. But I think that, you know, for people outside of anti-fascist circles, anti-fascism can feel really sort of ambiguous or even scary or unattainable or, you know, whatever matter of weirdness. And so it matters to us to make it palatable and accessible, so that, you know, people can really understand what's happening in their communities. Because at the end of the day, you know, we can't depend on the state to protect us. We have to protect us. And I hope, and it's my goal that the column helps aid in the anti-fascist work that's already happening across the country.
So let's talk about the goal that you all are trying to get to. You're trying to get to a certain amount, and then once that happens, you will start working on a podcast, and then that will come out on IGD as well. What's the goal that you're all trying to hit?
So we'd like to hit $1,000 a month in donations to be able to produce a podcast. You know, we understand that's quite lofty. And so we're hoping our supporters will come out, and, you know, help us work toward that, because, I know that, you know, we, like I said, accessibility is really, really important to me. Not everybody can sit down and read 3,600 words a week. I know that that's a lot. And so we want to be able to, you know, interview people and highlight other work that's happening and provide it in a different way for folks that maybe struggle with, you know, consuming all of the information by reading and maybe find it easier to digest via podcast. So that's the goal. That's the goal for us.
Well, one last question. What would you say to people that might be saying, like, well, this seems like a weird time to do this because, you know, it looks like Trump is going to leave office. You know, I'm sure that the far right will kind of be in a downward spiral. What would you say to that?
That's not how fascism works. Fascism doesn't just get voted out. Fascism has to be fought out and destroyed. How I feel about the column is that, you know, we do this like weekly roundup of covering the far right in the U.S. And co-author and I are anti-fascist badass femmes, and it really matters to us to be able to present this content to a general audience. You know, IGD is a powerful independent news source, and you know, we want to make sure that people have access to what's going on and understand what's going on as far as far right organizing, because it's, you know, Trump might leave office, but that doesn't mean that, you know, the Proud Boys are going to go away, or that some of these other organizations are going away, or that the threat of, you know, stochastic terrorism is going to go away. And just because, you know, Trump has left office, if he leaves office, which is kind of up in the air right now, given recent news, but, you know, it's that doesn't mean that, like, that fascism is going to go away with him. The people that desire a civil war where they can, you know, then create a white ethno state don't care who's in power. They're going to keep fighting toward that anyway. And so we have to keep fighting also. And it doesn't stop when Trump leaves office. The work continues.
I get high and do graffiti at night by myself. I practice what I'd say. They ever catch me, I'ma give them hell. I'll tell them, this is for everyone that this world took away from me that I loved. For every case that's been made, for every can of pepper spray, for every judge. The place is just to breathe, it has been picked by the sea. We're all waiting here in a slow flood. This place has no heart, been cursed from the start. The crowd only came for the blood. Too fast to die last, and I'm too old to die young. Too strong to let go, roots too cold, now I'm unable to ignore the world and drop it all and join the frenzy. Violence doesn't change a goddamn thing, but it feels nice to blend. This is for everyone that this world took away from me that I stopped. For the emptiness inside, for every pointless lie, for the parting of the ones that care for. Far and fade, yet to the fray, you're far away from the accountability. I know it's wrong, but this is what happens. This is what you get when everything comes back around. This is for everyone that this world took away from us that we loved. For the emptiness inside, for every pointless lie, the part of us that wants to care for. I last, I'm too old to die young. Too strong to let go, too cold, now I'm unable to ignore the world and drop it all. Enjoy the frenzy, violence doesn't change a goddamn thing. But it feels nice to play.
Right now, Trump and a lot of his supporters are refusing to accept the election. And what does that mean? Some people have brought up kind of this conception of like a bureaucratic coup, or like a slow snail's pace coup where they're just sort of dragging their feet. Right now, I mean, we'll talk about this a little later, but they're refusing to basically turn over certain things or have people sign certain things to kind of get the ball started to allow Biden and his team to kind of get in the door. So the big question is like, what does this all mean? Is this going to go anywhere? You know, we've never really seen anything like this before, so what will actually be the repercussions of this? Has there already been kind of a done deal made here? All of the major news corporations, including Fox News, have called it for Biden. So it seems like we're sort of on this slow march to Biden being put into power as the 46th president. But at the same time, Trump is being very clear that they're not going to go anywhere. So again, is this just a ploy for him to get immunity? Is he actually hoping to stay in power? Are they just kind of being dicks and we'll kind of see where this goes and maybe it won't go anywhere? There's a lot of things to talk about. So let's just dive into it. So just map out the big picture for us as you see it right now. You know, where are we at this point? What does this all mean, if anything?
Yeah. So I think there's a number of different narratives going on right now. And we'll get into sort of what Trump and the Trump campaign has been doing in a little bit, because they've actually been doing quite a lot, even though it might not seem like it. But essentially, you've got, I would say, sort of three different narratives kind of happening right now. The first most predominant narrative, and again, this is coming out, all the news, legitimate journalistic entities, including Fox, which for as much as Fox's opinion section is full of a bunch of right-wing reactionaries, their news section is actually still doing news. And what's been fascinating about specifically Fox is you've watched different opinion personalities on Fox sort of contradict each other. You've also watched the journalists on Fox calling out the other people on Fox who might even be interviewing them in the middle of interviews live on the air. Whenever they push a lie, the journalists are saying, but that's not true. Live on air on Fox. It's fascinating to watch. And so there's this first sort of dynamic here in which you're really watching this sort of implosion of what in the past I think people could refer to as something like the Trump coalition, right? And so you've got Trump, you've got regular traditional Republicans, you've got all of these people who are involved in the media apparatus of the right-wing ecosystem and things like that. And for a long time, they've been operating in sync with one another. But what you're seeing now is you're actually seeing a total fragmentation of that. You're seeing some Republican politicians, governors, senators, House reps, calling Joe Biden and congratulating him. You've got some like Mitch McConnell who are taking kind of a middle position, and they're sort of saying, we think it's really important to count every legal vote, blah, blah, blah. Although McConnell has kind of shifted that a bit. We're going to talk about that later as well. And then you have people who are just diehard, we're going to believe everything Trump says. People like Rudy Giuliani, a lot of Trump supporters kind of fall into this category. And what's going on here is the beginnings of a power struggle, right? In the process of that power struggle playing itself out, the sort of consensus narratives that build up around Trump's disinformation. So when Trump would boldface lie, everyone in the conservative ecosystem would sort of hedge just a bit while still sounding like they supported him or just straight out support the lie. That is all breaking apart. It's fragmenting. It's completely falling apart. And what that means is that Trump is coming out and saying stuff, or Kayleigh McEnany, the White House press secretary, or Rona McDaniel, the chairwoman of the RNC, are coming out and saying things, and nobody believes them. They're speaking purely to the people that voted for them, and not even all the people that voted for them believe them. Fox literally cut out of the middle of a White House press conference because Kayleigh McEnany was lying. And Fox went, this doesn't deserve to even be aired, and cut the feed in the middle of the press conference, which is the first time they've ever done that. And so that's one trajectory that's sort of happening now is you're kind of watching this fragmentation of the right-wing coalition that has been sort of operative in the U.S. since like 2015. The second trajectory that you're sort of seeing, the second narrative that's building up, is this sort of middle ground narrative that you're seeing a lot of moderates pushing, which is this sort of return to normalcy. We really need to kind of have Biden get into office and appoint a bunch of moderate people to cabinet positions and sort of return back to what existed under Obama. And that was, in reality, kind of the whole Biden pitch was, you really want another 4 years of Obama, don't you? I'm going to do what he did. I'm going to expand what he tried to do, blah, blah, blah. And it's all very grounded in this idea that normality was okay and that normality was preferable. And that tendency is also, though gaining inertia in the sort of transition process, which again, we'll talk about that a little bit more later, but though they're gaining inertia in the kind of transition process, the reality is that the people that voted for Joe Biden did not vote for Joe Biden. And we've said this before. They voted against Donald Trump. And though Biden is moving forward as if he has a political mandate and is sort of just moving on with his life, the people that voted for him aren't. And that's where you're getting a lot of the demonstrations that are happening. So this kind of like return to normalcy narrative, I guess, is sort of implicitly occurring. So it's not like there's people going out there and saying, yes, we need to return to the normalcy of the Obama years. But what's happening is that the media, a lot of politicians, so on, are just moving on as if this was a normal election. Like they're just saying, okay, cool, Biden won. Like let's start the transition process as if this was any other presidential election, which it was not. And things were very different on a lot of levels with this election. But I think what happened after Biden got announced as the winner by every legitimate news agency in the United States is that everyone went, okay, cool. Well, let's just like start the transition. And you've definitely seen a lot of this. Like the media at this point implicitly is treating this like any other transition. They're not even covering what Trump is saying anymore, except to talk about it as absurdity. And they're sort of just moving forward, right? Like they've returned to normalcy on some level or another.
But also Trump has like really hidden himself in a lot of ways too.
Yeah, he has. I mean, he's been trying to be loud through his surrogates, through people like Rudy Giuliani, through people like Kayleigh McEnany, through people like Rona McDaniel. But no one's really listening to them either. I mean, Rona McDaniel has been going all over cable news, spouting all this stuff, saying like, we know of we've had 11,000 reports of fake votes cast in Nevada. Now, of course, when the journalists go dig into any of those, because she won't show them the information except samples of the data, like she won't give journalists the data set. And even when journalists go through and check up on the hand-picked cases that the RNC is letting them see, they're finding one after another that all of those cases are just basic bad faith misunderstandings. So, for example, one of the cases involves a couple who voted absentee in Nevada, but lives in California. The husband is in the military and in a PhD program in California. Now, the RNC is saying these are people who voted fraudulently in Nevada. Now, of course, in the military, the rule is that if you are living in a place and you are deployed somewhere else on assignment, which getting a PhD is an assignment within the military, then you are to vote in the state that you lived in prior to your assignment, meaning that those people voted legally. Absolutely. And journalists have found that every single case, something like that. And so they're putting this stuff forward. Like Rudy Giuliani did that. For people that didn't see this, you have to look this up because it's absolutely amazing. Donald Trump put out on Twitter that Giuliani was going to do a press conference at the Four Seasons in Philadelphia. And then Giuliani obviously booked the wrong Four Seasons because they ended up doing a press conference in front of Four Seasons Total Landscaping, which is a landscaping company in North Philly, which is right next to a porn shop and across the street from a crematorium. And they did this whole press conference there, just like pretending like they didn't screw it up. It was hilarious. It was so good.
There was one article where they interviewed like the clerk that was on duty at the adult bookstore. And they were just like, yeah, they must be desperate.
I mean, the person I really want to talk to in this situation is the person who answered the phone at Four Seasons Total Landscaping, heard someone from the Trump campaign say, yeah, we want to do a press conference at the Four Seasons. And them knowing that they meant the other Four Seasons and still went, yeah, go ahead, do it anyways. Right? Like, I want to know who that person was because that's awesome. Like, great job. That's amazing. So that's kind of the second trajectory, which is like people going all in for Trump and then people sort of pretending like nothing's going on and sort of moving on, right? And the Trump people are trying as hard as possible to make the people that are moving on care about what they say, but they don't. Like, just nobody cares. Then you've got the third trajectory, which is happening, and this is where the demonstrations come in, where you do have a lot of people, specifically anarchists and socialists and stuff like that, that are making it very, very, very clear that Joe Biden does not have a political mandate. All over the country in major cities, there either have been demonstrations or demonstrations in the works to come forward and say, just because you won this election doesn't mean that you get the right to do what you want. Right. And people are coming out and saying things like, we have been fighting this uprising for months. we are the ones that doomed Donald Trump's reelection. It wasn't the Biden campaign. And therefore, we demand the ability to make things actually really functionally change. And that's not what Joe Biden is promising.
Are we going to see some sort of constitutional crisis or a coup develop? Because we talked about this like a lot in the run-up to the election. Yeah. And now that kind of the dust is settled, I think we can kind of like play up our predictions with the reality.
So I'm just going to come out and say, I think on January 20th, Joe Biden's going to get inaugurated. Like, I don't think that there's any chance that doesn't happen. The question that is still open is how much damage and in what ways will that damage occur between now and January 20th? And I think that there's some things which are very instructive, in understanding this. And I want to break this down into kind of three tendencies or three trends that are happening, three trajectories, right? You have this bureaucratic trajectory, which I want to talk about first. There's a kind of disinformation, misinformation, and popular mobilization trajectory, which is happening. And there's also this trajectory which has existed sort of within political circles, and we've talked about this at length already, so I'm going to be very brief when I talk about that. But let's just start with the bureaucracy. And to understand what's going on bureaucratically, we have to understand how transitions normally happen. So when someone gets elected president, if that is a new president, right? So if an incumbent is leaving office, what traditionally happens is that even before the vote totals are officially certified by governors, there's a small government agency called the General Services Administration. And what they do essentially, why no one has ever heard of them, they're essentially the property management arm of the federal government. So property that the government owns that is not under the sort of Department of the Interior, right, which would be national parks, national monuments, federal lands, things like that, or under the military, all other government properties are at least technically managed by the General Services Administration. That includes your federal buildings downtown, even FBI buildings, things like that. General Services Administration does things like run janitorial teams, fix toilets. Like that's literally what their job is. And so, of course, most Americans have never even heard of them. But they have this one other really weird job, which is that they are the agency which officially starts the transition process to a new administration. And the reason that happens is sort of an anomaly within American politics, right? It's kind of another really strange sort of outlying dynamic within American political history. So when an election is done, quote unquote, when it becomes very clear who the winner is going to be, the director of the GSA signs a transition document. And what that document essentially does is it allows the transition team for the incoming administration, to get office space in the Roosevelt Building, which is across the street from the White House, which is sort of, an executive office building, like an office building for the executive branch. Because not all executive branch employees can fit into the White House. Because the White House, a lot of it is, either ceremonial space or living space, right? And there's not a ton of offices there. Like cabinet officials have them and their aides have them. But really a lot of the other people that are like research people on the National Security Council, all that, they all work out of the Roosevelt Building. And so the transition team also works out of the Roosevelt Building. This has been the case ever since the Roosevelt Building was built. And the other thing that does is it releases budget. And that budget is some number of billions of dollars. But essentially what this document does is it says we are opening up the possibility of funding the transition. And then the transition team presents the GSA with the budget, which then gets approved as a formality and everything just kind of moves forward. So what's happening right now is that the director of the General Services Administration is refusing to sign the document. What she is saying is that it is not clear who won yet, that we need to wait for final election results, blah, blah, blah. The Biden team has already started doing the transition process, and they're privately funding it at this point. So they are buying computers and stuff, and they're setting up transition offices, and they're talking to people that used to work in the administration and stuff. And I'll get into that in a second. But they're doing all the things the transition team would do. They even have a budget for the GSA. They're just waiting for the document to get signed. And so by not signing that document, they're really – what's happening is that they're depriving the incoming Biden administration and their transition team office space, money, and in some cases access to different political appointees, right? Now, within the different bureaucracies themselves, memos have been issued telling, you know, staffers, right? Not political appointees, but career staffers, not to interact with the transition team. Now, traditionally, the political appointees just interact with the transition team. That I think we all understand at the end of the day, though a lot of politicians talk about hating each other, and having blood feuds with one another, they go out and eat dinner and stuff with each other afterwards, right? There's sort of a, it's sort of a polite opposition kind of dynamic, regardless of how heated the rhetoric gets. Now, under the Trump administration, that has changed. And a lot of the people that have been put into positions, are people that will not cooperate with an incoming Biden administration. So what the Biden administration is doing is kind of two things. The first is they are, threatening to and have already written up the briefs for a lawsuit against the General Services Administration. Now, a judge can force the GSA to sign that document. What the Biden team has done is essentially given a kind of vague deadline. They've said, we're moving forward right now on the transition process. And at the point in which we absolutely need access to this office space and this money, if the GSA has not signed this document, we will file a lawsuit. They will probably win that lawsuit. So there's that. The other thing that they're doing is they are talking to people who have either been fired by Trump or left their positions under the Trump administration about what's going on in the various different bureaucracies across the federal government. And I would guarantee that includes people like Rex Tillerson, who used to be Secretary of State, stuff like that. And so, again, some of these people are career employees of these agencies that have left. Some of these people were political appointees that have come to hate Donald Trump. But the Biden administration is definitely talking to these people. Now, that bureaucratic line of obstruction is not likely to be particularly successful. Where the Trump administration slash campaign's moves within the bureaucracy are going to be meaningful are actually more in the intelligence agencies, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Defense. And so over the last week, we've watched a large number of relatively significant people within the DOD and the DOJ resign or get fired. That includes Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense. That includes the person who, and I'm forgetting his name off the top of my head, the person at the Department of Justice who's involved in enforcing election law resigned. Because William Barr announced that federal prosecutors were going to essentially open the floodgates on investigating, quote, electoral fraud, even though there's no proof of that. You had the general counsel of the NSA leave this week. There have been rumors that Trump wants to fire both Gina Haspel, the director of the CIA, and Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI. And the tone of those rumors, the implication of those rumors, is that that has to do with refusing orders. Now, what those orders were is up for question. People at The Intercept seem to think that those orders had to do with releasing certain kinds of classified documents in public. There's definitely speculation that those refusals of orders had to do with things Trump tried to do to disrupt the election. We don't really know. What we do know is that Trump is appointing in an acting capacity a bunch of just random, really kind of fringy right-wing people like General John Tata, who is getting appointed to the position of Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. This is a person who is deeply Islamophobic and a conspiracy theorist, but was a general in Afghanistan for a period of time. People like this are getting appointed into these positions, and who knows what they're going to do. Depending on how the situation plays out, this is where the possibility of Trump still making some sort of play to stay in power exists. If Trump is replacing people in the Department of Defense, and the Department of Justice, there's clearly an attempt on his part to make some moves. Now, what those moves are, we don't know. I think within the administration, even within people in Congress and things like that, regardless of what they're saying publicly, privately, at least, according to sources I've talked to outlets like Politico, they're not actually talking about this on the level of winning the election or being able to stay in power. Even Trump has been pessimistic about that reality. And we can tell that if there was going to be a coup attempt, Trump didn't do that in a particularly smart way. You look at Max Boot, who's a conservative columnist for The Washington Post, wrote a really fascinating op-ed this week where he was saying, essentially, if the Trump administration, and Max Boot's a military theorist and studies coups, like seizures of power, on top of many other things, asymmetric warfare and things like that. But one of the things he was saying is that for a coup to be successful, you have to consolidate power really quickly after some event. Right. So in this case, if Trump were to try and engage in a coup, he would have to have consolidated control over the Department of Defense and Department of Justice, DHS, and things like that, in order to guarantee having the forces necessary to be able to make a play at staying in power. He did not do that. Now, it seems like there are kind of two reasons why. The first is the Trump administration is just not very organized. Or very knowledgeable, and they didn't move very quickly.
Are you saying after that glorious press conference of the Four Seasons, they are not working?
Yeah, right. Right. Well, and they can't even get their own narrative straight. They haven't been able to since Election Day. But the other basic reality is that they probably met bureaucratic resistance to making any kinds of moves which would actually disrupt the election. That there's a lot of people within the federal bureaucracy, especially in agencies like the Department of Defense, which, regardless of how we might feel about what they do, they see themselves as loyal citizens and adherents to American liberal democracy. They take oaths to that. They believe in those. That's very meaningful to them.
Also, let's get real here. I mean, Trump has, you know, pushed his tax cut through, yeah. You know, put conservatives on the Supreme Court. You know, push through a lot of deregulation and, you know, pro-business policies, rolled back the Obama-era regulations on the banking industry. I mean, he's given them a lot of stuff, especially with the way that Congress is stacked right now. The Democrats probably won't be able to do anything about for the next at least 4 years.
Right, right. So that actually brings up the second trajectory here, right? We were talking about what's going on in Congress earlier. But we didn't talk about why. So the position of a person like Mitch McConnell has changed. Right after the election, they were essentially right on the verge of congratulating Joe Biden. They had said there wasn't really any election fraud. They talked about how, you know, they were interested in all the votes getting counted. They weren't really, you know, that excited about disrupting that process and so on. But their tone has kind of changed a bit. McConnell's now talking about, you know, well, you know, if there's no election fraud, then there's no problem with the lawsuits and things like that. And he's kind of like hedging a bit. Now, there have been a couple of really solid analyses of this that have come out in the last day or two. And I think that this is really important to talk about right now. So for Trump to make any significant plays at disrupting the process or even creating the image that he's disrupting the process, which, you know, if that's what he's trying to do, that's also not succeeding, but that would be an attempt to kind of keep Trumpism mobilized, right? And I'll get to the popular mobilization part in a second. But within Congress, we have to keep in mind that control of the Senate is going to come down to 2 seats. And both of those seats are related to the runoff elections that are going to happen in Georgia. Now, the way that elections happen in Georgia is that Georgia has a runoff system. And what that means is that everybody who's running for the office runs at the same time. There's no primaries, right? So all the Republicans and all the Democrats all run at once. And one of two things happens. Either one candidate gets more than 50% of the vote, at which case they just win. But if nobody gets more than 50%, then there's a runoff between the two top vote getting candidates. Now, because of just some strangeness around a senator from Georgia getting appointed to a position and the governor having to appoint someone in that person's stead. We've ended up with a situation in which both senatorial seats from Georgia are up for election at the same time, and both of those seats have gone to a runoff. And so part of, at least the speculation here, is that part of what someone like McConnell is doing is essentially paying lip service to Donald Trump in order to keep the base mobilized enough to both fund and build support for these two runoff campaigns in an attempt to keep control of Georgia, because essentially they lost Georgia in a presidential election, which was almost unthinkable prior to this election, like before the actual day of the election. Was absolutely unthinkable. What that means is that they are at significant risk of losing both of those seats to Democrats. And if that happens, then they've lost control of the Senate. Because remember, if the Senate breaks down 50-50, which is what would happen if the Republicans lost both of those seats, the tie-breaking vote on everything comes down to the vice president, which at this point is Kamala Harris, who will vote with Democrats every single time. And so control of the Senate is really up for question right now. And so I think for McConnell, there is a motivation to humor what Trump is doing. You got to keep in mind, like, and we've been hearing stories like this for the last 4 years, but they become a lot more frequent. Normal Republican politicians, people that have been in Republican politics for a long time, think of Donald Trump like a child that they have to manage. And they have to manage his outbursts, they have to manage his tantrums, and they're constantly sort of having to respond to tweets and things like this. And it's exhausting for them. That's not why they got into politics. And so in this case, they're sort of humoring him in order to maintain support from his base so they can at least get through this runoff election, which happens at the beginning of January, right? That's kind of the goal here. But I think what that's doing is it's providing the basis for the third trajectory of what's happening here, which is Trump trying to mobilize people on a sort of popular mobilization basis. Now, you see a number of sort of mechanisms through which they're doing that. For example, the ridiculous press conference at Four Seasons Total Landscaping in Philadelphia with Rudy Giuliani was an attempt to announce that they had all of this evidence of voter fraud and they were going to file all of these lawsuits. And of course, none of that has come to fruition because they don't have any evidence that's real in any sort of way. One of the people that they talked about during that press conference, for example, was a United States Postal Service worker who filed an affidavit claiming that their supervisor was backdating ballots so they would be able to arrive and be counted, right? So ballots that were cast after Election Day. This person was claiming in a legally signed affidavit that their supervisor is backdating ballots. Now, not only is that not possible for a lot of reasons based on how mail is tracked in the United States, and not only did that all come through Project Veritas, who never tells the truth about anything, but the person recanted literally the day after the press conference and said, oh, yeah, that was all it was all a lie. Sorry, I don't really know what to tell you, and signed an entire other legal affidavit saying that. I would argue that there's four things going on here that are really kind of driving this mobilization strategy. Before even getting into those four things, I want to emphasize that, you know, maybe across the United States, in the entire country last weekend, there might have been 10 to 15,000 Trump supporters out. That's like nothing. There were that many people at anti-police brutality demonstrations in Philadelphia in May, just Philadelphia. Those 2,000 people that showed up in Philly to protest the vote count, those people came from all over the country. And this is one of these, I think, implicit mythologies that we have to crush when it comes to people on the left, a kind of post left and things like that. Then we look at something like Unite the Right as disturbing. And it is. It is very disturbing to see 1,000 Nazis marching in the streets of America. That is really disturbing. However, that's all the people they could get from all over the country to show up there. That's it. When groups like that try and have rallies locally, they're pulling 20, 30 people. And we can see that. Today, Nick Fuentes went to Lansing, Michigan. He's been kind of doing stops on his way to D.C. So he went to Madison, Wisconsin yesterday and got rained out. Then he went to Lansing today. And this is, you know, Nick Fuentes, the leader of the Grapers, like this person that is supposedly very powerful on the right. His rally had 30 people at it. That's it. 30 people at it. I have been at anti-war vigils run by liberals multiple years after the war in Iraq started that had more than 30 people at them. Right? Demonstrations that get called on an hour's notice have more than 30 people at them. Okay. This demonstration is getting boosted by the president and Sean Hannity. And that means they're getting millions and millions of dollars of free advertising for this thing. And again, Nick Fuentes has been a huge booster of this thing and drew 30 people. We've seen a couple of other people try and do, like, Joe Vival has been doing a couple of rallies on his way to DC, and he's only pulling 5 to 10 people at these things. And I think the real reality is something that comes back to the anti-war movement. There used to be this kind of formula that people used to use, which was, say there was a week of action, or a weekend of action, or a day of action. The week before, there was a huge mobilization in Washington, D.C., which was pretty common. And say 2 million people showed up around the country for the day of action at the local actions, right? 2 million people. You could expect about 5% of that number to show up in D.C., right? Maybe 10% if you were very lucky. Because at the end of the day, going to Washington, D.C. is a kind of a big investment. You know, it's often significantly far away from where you are, like in the sense that that is a day of travel, that you have to find hotels if you're not taking a bus. The right wing doesn't really have enough organization or numbers to really organize like bus caravans like the anti-war movement used to. And so it's an investment to go to Washington, D.C., and you can very much expect the numbers to be very small. So let's just say that 15,000 Trump supporters showed up last weekend all across the United States, right? Let's even be let's even give them credit and say it was 20,000. 5% of that number would be about 1,000 people. And that's everybody they can get with Sean Hannity and the president doing outreach for this action. Okay. Now, within the organizing for this, and this is kind of the first point of why this is happening. Within the organizing for this, you've seen various different groups and various different segments within the right wing call this rally totally different things. They are doing outreach to just their constituencies. They're not even doing outreach to other people. You can definitely see this playing itself out on Parler a lot right now. A lot of those organizations and circles are in the middle of their own power struggles, right? So the Proud Boys, for example, are in the middle of a power struggle where Kyle Chapman is trying to take control of the organization from Enrique Tarrio, which has been covered nationally at this point, right? And a lot of other circles are going through this. I mean, like the MAGA crowd is having this kind of power struggle. QAnon is having this kind of power struggle, right? Like this is pretty common, the Republican Party. And so all of these different constituencies have a reason to try and turn their people out in D.C. And part of that has to do with showing numbers to be able to say we are the biggest faction or we are the ones that should really be in control because we're the ones that are able to mobilize. And so part of the way that this rally is playing out has a lot to do with internal power struggles within the right. What that has led to is such a level of disorganization that even journalists can't figure out who's actually running the show at this rally, like which organization is actually in charge of this thing. And no one has decided to file for a protest permit yet, which, you know, you don't need a permit to have a rally in Washington, D.C., but you do need one to have one on the Capitol Hill district, which is where they're trying to do this thing. And no one has decided to apply for a permit, which permits in DC take multiple weeks to sometimes wind their way through the system, right? Even if you're trying to expedite, it still takes 4 or 5 days.
Well, especially if you're going to do what they're probably trying to do, which is like have speakers, have amplification.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you need a permit to tap into the power down at the National Mall, which is how these huge stages power themselves. Like, that's all not getting powered by generators. Like, there's actually power that you can tap into on the National Mall, but you need a permit for that, right? I mean, but they're not doing any of that. Like, they're just not. And so I think a lot of, at least in the initial sense on the right, on the kind of activist right, this is about a power struggle. And people are kind of struggling over who's going to run what faction, who's going to have what power after Donald Trump. I think the second motivation here from Trump is a kind of first step goal, which is having a future after the White House. Donald Trump is always a person who plays kind of plays strategies which always have multiple objectives. And in this case, there's kind of the objective of not going to prison and leaving power and having a future. And then this kind of secondary objective, or what in tech circles people would call like a stretch goal, is staying in power, right? Which is incredibly unlikely, I would even argue impossible. So Trump needs to set himself up to leave office gracefully, with enough support that he's not going to get prosecuted. So Trump kind of has two options for not getting prosecuted. The first is negotiating immunity, which he still might very much do. And there's definitely indications that he's angling towards that. Or having enough support on the street in which the Department of Justice under Joe Biden decides that it's, quote, not in the national interest, which is sort of a thing that, that the DOJ will say, to prosecute a certain person. For example, even prior to sort of the Gerald Ford pardon of Richard Nixon, which happened on Ford's first day in office, as it became pretty clear that Nixon was either going to resign or get impeached, there was this discussion that arose about whether Nixon was going to get prosecuted. And one of the things that people within the Department of Justice were saying is, yeah, maybe, but it might be determined that it's not in the national interest to do that. And so what that means essentially is that if a person, individual person, were to be prosecuted, that it would cause a crisis which would outweigh the benefits of the prosecution, right? So in this case, it could be that Trump is angling for a position in which he has enough support visibly that if he leaves office, it will be harder to prosecute him because it might cause a national crisis, right? And that's definitely part of what he's angling towards. I think the third thing that's happening here is he's angling potentially towards that stretch goal. And what that means is that he has to mobilize significant support on the streets to be able to keep up enough inertia in order to be able to push these court challenges through, watch them fail, and then still have enough energy to be able to contest the election results in the streets. And the goal of that, again, is twofold. One is negotiating an exit. The second is potentially staying in power, which, again, is increasingly unlikely by the day. And so Trump having support on the streets is meaningful for him, for his future. But I think the kind of fourth reality here is really looking at the current position that the Republican Party is in. And so if you really look at what's going on with the Republican Party, what you see is you see, again, a minority party that's been in power through political machinations for a while, but that the possibility of maintaining that is collapsing by the day, and that this is probably the last election that they can pretty seriously contest. We have to keep in mind that the Republican Party has lost the popular vote in 7 out of the last 8 elections, yet they've somehow won 3 of those, right? 3 of those 8. 2 of those were elections where they lost the popular vote, right? And now 3, right? So Joe Biden, right? They lost the popular vote here. So they have lost the popular vote in 7 out of 8 elections, presidential elections. They have lost the popular vote in 8 out of 8 congressional elections, like the aggregate popular vote. And that's an indicator to them. And that indicator is that they're not going to stay in power for very long. Now, in order to plan their future, they need to have there's sort of two conflicts that are playing themselves out. The first is official, right? So we talked about this before, but this has to do with the Georgia Senate runoffs that are happening, going to happen in January. They need to mobilize not just supporters in Georgia, but they need to mobilize Republicans everywhere to donate money to those campaigns. The second thing that's going on here, again, is there has to be for them some way to keep their base engaged. Their base is not politically in line with where the most of the Republican Party is. But what moderate Republicans have to do right now is they have to, like people like McConnell or Lindsey Graham, people that have been playing along with Trumpism and even encouraging it, but traditionally are not of that sort of political persuasion. What they need to do is they need to simultaneously take control of the Republican Party while also maintaining their ability to get elected. Now, I think a lot of them realize that Trump mobilized people to come out into the streets in a way that no Republican candidate has done in probably since Reagan, and maybe even before that, maybe potentially since Barry Goldwater. There hasn't really been this kind of fervor on the streets amongst conservatives. And so you have a number of Republican politicians, and they did this with the Tea Party too, although they lost, they failed with the Tea Party, but you have a number of Republican politicians who need those votes. They need that energy. They need those small donations. They need all of that. And they still need to maintain control of the party. Now, they tried to do that during the Tea Party, and there was many years of dynamics prior to the Tea Party, starting with Newt Gingrich in the mid-90s, where the Republicans were mobilizing things like conspiracy theory, things like militia groups, stuff like that, as a way to gain political inertia and to either undermine or perpetuate and encourage certain policies. We definitely saw this with border policy, where even when Democrats ran both the executive branch and Congress, they couldn't pass comprehensive immigration reform because the Republican Party had mobilized popular resistance to it to the degree that they can. Like, there were protests in the streets, the Minutemen were on the border, various militia groups were on the border, and that created enough leverage for the Democrats to not just push through the immigration reform that they thought that they wanted. And so there is a reason to do that. Now, with the Tea Party, though, that same group of moderate Republicans lost control of the Republican Party. When the Tea Party, like Freedom Caucus, quote unquote, entered the House in 2010, they kind of took control of the show, and they weren't necessarily loyal Republicans, and they made their own demands on legislation in order to get their votes. And in that process, people like Paul Ryan lost control. People like John Boehner before him lost control, and John Boehner was actually forced out by the Freedom Caucus. So we have to keep in mind that even before Trumpism, the Republican Party was, you know, to use the term, a house divided upon itself, right? It was the infighting was systemic. And so I think what's happening here, at least in part, and why the sort of traditional Republicans in the Senate are not coming out, because this strategy of popular mobilization is incredibly dangerous, right? You mentioned a little bit about Proud Boys in Sacramento attacking people. I know where I live, there was a rally of about 150, which is small given the size of the city I live in. But there were four or five Proud Boys there with weapons and stuff. The strategy could get someone killed. In fact, I would almost argue will get someone killed eventually. We've already seen multiple bombing plots shut down. We've already seen multiple assassination plots shut down. And all of that is a response to this popular mobilization strategy, which lives on the back of this attempt to delegitimize the election. And what Trump is creating in this process is a situation in which American politics will remain not just inherently divided, but militantly divided, dangerously divided upon itself, in the sense that the violence that we're seeing is going to continue, right? I would say that that's probably a necessary part of the process of changing everything, but is going to continue, unfortunately, right? None of us should glorify political violence for as much as we might think it's necessary. And so for someone like McConnell to not step forward and say something about a strategy which imperils his control as much as everyone else's really tells you a lot about what he's trying to get out of this situation, which is that he is trying to see a world beyond Donald Trump in which he is in control of a Republican base, which has some inertia behind it, which has the ability to mobilize people in the streets, right? And is willing to risk significant levels of political violence in order to make that possible. And that's incredibly dangerous, but that's sort of where we are. So what I think what we're sort of looking at is a scenario in which the predictions that people made, including us, were correct, right? There was an attempt to mobilize, a campaign to delegitimize and invalidate the election, and it failed. And it failed because Trump is not very organized. The people around him are not very knowledgeable. That there were a lot of people within bureaucracies that were either resistant to that because of principle or were resistant to that because of the power of the uprising in the streets. And they didn't want to see the entire country fall apart because that is what would have happened. And so they pulled back from the precipice. And Trump failed at doing that. And now what is happening is now the second part of this process. And remember, we still have a long time between now and January 20th. And in that period of time, we're going to watch one of two things really go down here. We're going to either watch Trump be successful in mobilizing people in the streets, at which point he's not going to stay in office. But the process of getting rid of him is going to be violent and potentially bloody and definitely, definitely destructive. Or we're going to watch him fail at that. We're going to watch all the lawsuits that they filed fail because judges are literally laughing their lawyers out of courts. We're going to watch all of their sort of what's left of their support within mainstream Republican circles kind of evaporate as we get closer to January 20th. And as Republicans start to people like McConnell start to see that they have more to gain by cooperating with Biden than they have by standing by Trump, which will happen probably around the beginning of January. That we'll see that right after the Georgia runoff. We'll start to see a lot of these sort of traditional Republicans change their tune pretty quickly. We're going to see the beginnings of a Republican strategy of disruption, to disrupt the Biden administration, which again requires this kind of support on the streets. But if Trump fails a popular mobilization here, we could watch this whole thing wither away and die. Not quietly, but wither away and die after creating a constitutional crisis, which will just be resolved at some point because it's in at least the politician's best interest to resolve it. And I think we have to keep that in mind here. All of these people in Washington, D.C., with the exception of Trump, have a incentive, a very important, deeply held incentive to resolve this thing. Because at the end of the day, if they don't, and this causes a massive political crisis in the United States, they don't have a government of which to run, or they don't have a mechanism through which to govern. That we have to remember that politicians themselves sit in Washington, D.C., or your state capitol, or your city hall, writing documents, making declarations, essentially, saying what they think should happen. But those documents don't mean anything outside of the police, outside of the enforcement mechanism, the police and the courts and the prison system, to impose the will of those people and consequently the will of cops and judges and prison guards and so on. Outside of that mechanism of organized warfare, this organized occupation of our streets that we see every day, this kind of perpetual constant war that we live in the midst of all the time, outside of that perpetual war, politicians are just people writing down stuff on pieces of paper. And so all of these people have an incentive to resolve this thing with the least disruption possible. So we have to think about what's going on for everybody else in the Republican Party with that in mind, that they are humoring Donald Trump because they have something to gain out of this process. They will pull back from humoring him when they no longer have something to gain, which will happen after the Georgia runoff. But in the meantime, the big X factor questions that will arise here are not, have nothing to do with the lawsuits. All those lawsuits are going to fail. Even if, and I forgot who it was, did the math on this. Even if every single one of those lawsuits succeeded, Trump would still lose the election. Like, they're not contesting enough votes to change anything. He would still lose. Even if Georgia magically flips during the hand recount, he would still lose, right? Like, there's not really a mathematical way that he wins the election, right? Even if they're somehow magically successful, which they're not being successful. That's not the concern. I think the thing that the questions that are open are kind of threefold. The first is, to what degree is Trump going to be able to mobilize people in the streets? And what is that going to mean on the level of political violence? I think that that's an open question, and I think we're going to have an answer to that after Saturday. If this rally on Saturday turns into nothing, which, keep in mind, every other time they've tried to have a rally in D.C., it has turned into nothing, right? Like, people don't even talk about the mother of all rallies anymore, which happened in 2017, 2018.
But the Juggalos totally overshadowed with their numbers?
Yes, with the Juggalos. Yes, exactly. And the Juggalos, like ICP held a rally on the same day, partially to protest the FBI, like, classifying them as a gang, but partially also because they just hate Trump and hate racists. And so all the Juggalos showed up in D.C. to, like, screw with them, essentially. And they outnumbered the people at the mother of all rallies by, like, 20 to 1, right? And it was, like, just Juggalos. They've never been successful in mobilizing numbers in D.C. And so if they are not successful in mobilizing numbers, I think what you're going to see is you're actually going to see a defeatism kind of take over here. That for Trump, this is a risky strategy. Not just on the level of fostering political violence, but on the level of losing inertia. That if he fails at organizing effectively to get people to D.C., you're going to watch a lot of conservatives leave the first stage of the grief process. Like, they're going to leave the denial stage and start to move down that pathway to coping with reality, right? And at that point, you're going to watch the mobilization level drop, and they'll probably lose the runoff elections in Georgia. If he's successful in mobilizing numbers in D.C., we might have a very tragic couple of months on our hands. I'm not saying that your normal Trump supporter is going to run out and start shooting people, because that's never the case. But that 5% or even 2% fringe of that world is going to feel, and already does feel to a degree, very emboldened. We already watch people get arrested for threatening to shoot up the vote count center in Philadelphia. There was a person that was just arrested for plotting the assassination of Chuck Schumer. And stories like this emerge multiple times a day at this point. And these are all people that are emboldened by the narrative of election fraud, the misinformation, disinformation campaign that Trump is using to try and mobilize people in the streets. The other trajectory, so this kind of third open question, is what do these new appointees within the political bureaucracy do? I don't think a lot of people are talking about this yet, because it just has emerged. But the fact that Donald Trump is appointing far right wing conspiracy theorists to lead positions within the Department of Defense, which controls an almost $1 trillion budget and has millions of people under arms, is really disturbing. Now, that does not in any way translate to the military itself, as far as career military people being okay with deploying American troops onto American streets. Like, don't think that's true for a second. But it definitely creates the possibility of there being a split within the military or a split within the armed forces, and some possibility of maybe that emerging, given the right circumstances and the right ability of them to justify it. I think the other thing that's going to be really interesting is what happens in the Department of Justice now that they've decided to launch this, quote, investigation into voter fraud. Now, normally when they launch an investigation like this, nothing happens. Like, when was the last time any of us heard about the investigation into the Mueller investigation? Like, John Durham, the person who's running that, has been essentially totally silent for the last 6 months. We haven't heard almost anything from it because they found nothing. They will find nothing here, too. I think the bigger question is whether they try and fabricate something, which the Department of Justice has done with intelligence reports already. So these are all the X factors in play. Just because Trump's attempt to delegitimize the election and potentially stay in power failed. That doesn't mean that follow-up attempts aren't going to be destructive. And we are not in any way out of the woods yet. I think the uprising sent a very clear message over the last series of months of what would happen if there was an attempt to seize power. And I think that that was incredibly meaningful as far as creating obstructions in the process of trying to organize a coup. But we're not done yet. And there's still a long way to go. And we're going to be talking about this all the way until January 25th.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.